like to now introduce to you our second keynote lecturer for this conference, Professor Andrea Smith. And I want to say that I'm actually very thrilled to be here introducing her to you. And as you can see from the information in your program, Professor Smith is a highly accomplished scholar and activist. She is currently an assistant professor in the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. Her work focuses on issues of violence against women of color and their communities, specifically Native American women. Professor Smith's latest book, published in 2008, is called Native Americans and the Christian Right, The Gendered Politics of Unlikely Alliances. She is co-founder of Insight, Women of Color Against Violence, the Boarding School Healing Project, and the Chicago chapter of Women of All Red Nations. In 2005, Professor Smith was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in recognition of her research and work regarding violence against women of color in the U.S. I could go on to list many more of her accomplishments, but instead I'd like to take a few minutes to tell you a bit about why I personally am so delighted to be welcoming her and why we immediately thought of her as a keynote for this conference, given its theme of interrogating the idea of doing good. In the late 1990s, I worked at a predominantly white, government-funded rape crisis center. This was, in one sense, a very meaningful job for me because I was committed to working towards ending sexual violence. But at the same time, I was profoundly uneasy in the organization I was in. I didn't have the language nor the analysis to understand it then, but in a very visceral and embodied way, I knew there was something very wrong with the work we were doing and the way we were doing it. Yet because this was an organization with such righteous conviction that we were doing good, it was very difficult to name this unease. And somehow at this time, I happened upon an ad for a conference taking place in April 2000 at the University of California in Santa Cruz. And the title of that conference alone made it clear to me that I had to attend. The conference was called The Color of Violence, Violence Against Women of Color. There, I saw women who would eventually become my intellectual mentors, including Angela Davis, Kimberly Crenshaw, and Hunani K. Trask, just to name a few. And the ways in which violence against women was being conceived at this conference helped me to see that one cannot end violence against women without tackling racism, colonialism, immigration policies, land rights, the prison system, militarism, heterosexist normativity, and neoliberalism. In short, this conference made clear the inextricable links between personal and state violence. It also helped me to see that the refusal to address these issues in feminist organizations is a form of violence in and of itself. My experience of this conference was far from exceptional. It left an impression on a great number of women and sparked what has since become the Insight Women of Color movement. At the center of this truly remarkable event was a very modest Cherokee feminist anti-violence activist named Andrea Smith, who also worked as a rape crisis counselor at the time. Needless to say, she was a great inspiration, and I've been following her work ever since. Now, nearly 10 years later, I teach at a women's studies program here at Concordia University. And in my courses, we grapple with how systems of oppression interlock to produce conditions of violence. To my mind, few scholars illustrate such an analysis as effectively as Andrea Smith does. In her wonderful book, Conquest, Sexual Violence and American Indian Genocide, published in 2005, a book that won the Gustavus Myers Outstanding Book Award, Professor Smith writes about Native American women activist communities in the U.S. and astutely captures the impossibility of choosing sides between gender and race. The danger of such a separation, Professor Smith reminds us, is that it fails to recognize that it is precisely through sexism and gendered violence that colonialism and white supremacy have been successful. More recently, Professor Smith co-edited another incredible book entitled The Revolution Will Not Be Funded. If I'm not mistaken, she will be presenting some of this today in her talk entitled Captured by the State, the Anti-Violence Movement, and the Nonprofit Industrial Complex. We're all very keen to hear this talk, so I'll stop here and ask you to join me in welcoming Professor Andrea Smith. Thank you very much for the very nice introduction. In fact, the analysis was so great, I think I don't even have to give a talk. And I also want to give thanks to the indigenous peoples on whose land we stand and to the organizers of this conference. And I'm very excited that the links were made in this conference between settler colonialism in the U.S. and Canada and what's going on in Palestine. And I think when we analytically bring these two together, we see that the question of the nation state comes squarely on the table, which I'll talk about later. So I thank you very much for doing that. I think many people are starting to make these links, and I think we need to proliferate this analysis. Okay, so as was just mentioned, we talk about the politics of doing good. Certainly my biggest mistakes were in the anti-violence movement, where I've been active in for the past 20 years, where I spent a lot of time thinking I was doing good, only to say, oops, I think I made a tragic mistake. But anyway, I think that's part of what organizing is. If we become too invested in feeling we always did the right thing, we fail to notice that the way oppression operates is that it changes. So even if we come up with a good strategy at one moment, it may not be a good strategy at the next moment. So we should never be wedded to these strategies, but always flexible and always engage in a process of self-critique. So just to give a little bit of kind of the history of how I started to see the complicity of the anti-violence movement in this state, was I was part of kind of the Women of Color Caucus mode of organizing in the National Sexual Assault movement in the U.S. And if you've been part of kind of this Women of Color Caucus organizing, it could be any other kind of caucus, the Indigenous Caucus, whatever. But basically the model of this organizing is you're attached to a larger body that's either, say, male-dominated or white-dominated, and you spend all your time yelling at the people in charge, and if you do a good job of it, they start to pay you to yell at them. And it becomes financially lucrative at some points, but actually it doesn't change anything because they don't think you're going anywhere. So you get paid to be the radical critic, but you don't actually change the way organizing is done. So what this tended to mean was when we had kind of the domestic violence or sexual assault 40-hour trainings, there would be this great concern that we must be, you know, racially inclusive. So we would put a medicine wheel on the training that was done for everybody else, and suddenly it became an indigenous model. So this was kind of the politics of inclusion that we were addressing. So we decided we were getting a little tired of this after about, you know, 10, 15 years of this kind of shenanigans, and said, what if we do a different kind of organizing? And instead of trying to include us into these models that were built without us in mind, what if we centered ourselves in the analysis and asked ourselves, what would it take to build a movement that could end violence against women of color? Well, when we framed it in this way, we started to see that we had to address state violence at the same time we address interpersonal gender violence. And when we make those links, we started to see then that this would actually change the way we look at violence, not just for women of color, but for everybody. So we kind of practiced a model of recentering rather than a model of inclusion. So then we then had to then develop a critique, not just about the racism and the anti-violence movement, but the way the movement had been co-opted by the state. So to make that very sad story short, you know, before the movement started to develop, say in the 70s or so, there's the idea, you know, women were going to get together and end violence in our communities. Do you need a place to stay? Maybe you can stay in my basement. Is there a perpetrator at your work? Maybe we can go harass them. You know, but this idea, we can kind of think of strategies where we're going to address violence ourselves. But the state, being the sneaky thing that it is, comes in and says, you know, little ladies, it looks like you all have a problem with violence. And we'd like to give you a grant to solve this problem. However, when you accept our grant, you accept all the stipulations that go with this grant. So we are not going to fund any unseemly rabble-rousing activities. No, we think the problem is that survivors are victims. They are ill and they need professional therapy from somebody with an MSW or a PhD. And if you want to do any activist work, we want you to work with the state. We want you to work with the criminal justice system because, as it so happens, we're building up the prison industrial complex, and we'd like to co-opt your feminist rhetoric to support our repressive anti-crime agenda. So it's not too long before you have many anti-violence programs actually locating themselves in police departments and effectively operating as an arm of the state. For instance, there was this one shelter in South Dakota that was conducting background searches on their clients and having them arrested if they had any outstanding warrants. And of course, these programs were not making any critiques of state violence. When I was in Chicago and anti-immigration legislation was being deliberated, they said, we cannot take a stand on this because this is not an anti-violence issue. And so, as Nanya Bhattacharjee says, we can't go march against the police for police brutality, then go to them for domestic violence as if they're two separate institutions. But essentially what happened is because we became co-opted by the state, we could then no longer have a critique of the state. And what we failed to ask ourselves is, it was all this work with the criminal justice system actually leading to less violence. And what we found out is that study after study after study is showing that prisons don't have an effect on crime rates. They don't lead to less violence. And this may not be the time to do the extended analysis of the prison industrial complex, but to also make that long story short, I mean, most of the people there in prison are there because of either drugs. Well, you can get drugs easier in prison, and there's no treatment facilities there. Or if you're there for crimes of poverty, what does a prison sentence do but give you a police record, a prison record, and make it less likely you can get a job? And when we talk about issues of violence, well, if the issue was there's a few wacko dudes we need to lock up, maybe the prison system might make sense as a strategy. But when you have studies in which half of men say they would rape somebody if they thought they could get away with it, you'd either have to lock up half the male population, which maybe somebody might argue, but it's very financially unfeasible. So when we're talking about a society that largely condones violence, what you have is a political organizing problem. You have to transform communities so that they no longer tolerate violence. However, I should just briefly mention then when we had this critique of the prison system, and I should also mention that the New York Times actually came out with a study that showed that the net result of all these laws that we passed that were supposed to help us have led to a situation where battered women are killing their partners less often, but batterers are not killing their partners less often. And in fact, many of the laws we tried to get passed, like mandatory arrest laws, where the police have to arrest somebody on a domestic violence case, have basically been used against survivors because now perpetrators now know to call the police first. So Beth Ritchie found that a half to a quarter of women in Chicago jails are there on domestic violence charges. So this is an example where the things we thought were going to help us end up being used against us in a number of ways. But then when we have to look at what's the alternative to this, the thing that was usually proffered was the restorative justice system, right? So the idea here is that if there's a crime, it's not just between two individuals, but there's been a breakdown in the community. And therefore, instead of taking that person out of the community, how do you get the whole community involved in holding this person accountable? But of course, the problem is that these models tend not to work when it comes to gender violence, because if a community is going to hold somebody accountable, they have to think what happened was bad. And in the case of gender violence, they often don't side with the person who's been victimized, but with the perpetrator. So therefore, what we realize is that while we want to develop community-based responses, we can't do so with a romanticized notion of community that's not sexist, homophobic, or otherwise problematic, or even presume that a community is there in the first place. So again, that's why it becomes a political organizing problem rather than kind of a model social service problem. How do we organize in a way to create communities of accountability where violence starts to become unthinkable? So with that then, Incite Women of Color Against Violence formed, and we asked ourselves, well, if the state's not the solution, what else could be the solution? And we really didn't know, but we thought, let's just do activist institutes around the country and start to see what ideas might come up. And one thing that developed in this process is that one workshop, somebody said, you know, this is actually a problem I'm dealing with right now because in my apartment complex, there's a man that's beating his wife, and I don't trust the police, I don't want to call them, but I also don't want this violence to continue. And when she said this, it made me realize how this criminal justice approach had actually individualized not just survivors of violence, but also people who might intervene, because it never occurred to her to organize the apartment complex to do something. So the question is, if you ask yourself the question, what can I do? There's not much you can do other than call the police or do nothing. But if you ask yourself the question, what can we do? Then a lot of ideas start to develop, and that's what we found. When we asked ourselves, what can we do? Many groups had lots of creative ideas, so we started to collect them all, we put them on the website, and then many groups started to develop their own community accountability processes. And when we developed these ideas, we saw these as a kind of a proactive and a creative process rather than a negative process. That is, the idea was not to say, if you're under attack, you can't call the police. Because if you're under attack, you do what you need to do. The question isn't, should you call the police or not? The question is, why have we given you no other options but to call the police? So how do we then start to proliferate the alternatives that eventually squeeze out these things that are not working? Similarly, when you think of the prison abolitionist movement, again, it's a creative response. It's not tear down all prison walls tomorrow, it's crowd out prisons with other things that work effectively and bring communities together rather than destroying them. So with that then, however, we started to see that kind of this critique of the prison industrial complex for addressing state violence has more radical ramifications because when we talk about making violence against women a crime, we think about the word crime. What are we to do with the fact that in the United States, genocide has never been a crime? In fact, genocide has often been the law itself, right? So with that then, how do we, when we look at the prison industrial complex, we see it's really the arm of a nation state form of governance that's based on the logics of violence, domination, and control. And when we therefore try to address issues of gender and racial injustice through the state, we then are then not able to look at how the state is itself constituted by violent settler colonialism, heteropatriarchy, and white supremacy. And of course, I think Native feminist theory in particular makes a critical intervention because there could be no U.S. or Canada without the continuing genocide of Native peoples. Sandy Grand states, "The United States," and you can substitute Canada if you'd like, "is a nation defined by its original sin, the genocide of American Indians. American Indian tribes are viewed as an inherent threat to the nation, poised to expose the great laws of U.S. democracy, that we are a nation of laws and not random power, that we are guided by reason and not faith, and that we are governed by representation and not executive order. And finally, that we stand in a self-determined citizenry and not a kingdom of blood or aristocracy. From the perspective of American Indians, democracy has been wielded with impunity as the first and most virulent weapon of mass destruction." And I should note that after 9/11, even radical scholars started to complain about how the great ideals of democracy have been eroded by the Bush regime. But I think if we understand genocide as foundational to U.S. democracy, we actually realize that Bush's policies are the fulfillment of U.S. democracy, not an aberration to it. So, by the way, my views do not represent that of University of California. Okay, so when we do not presume that the U.S. should or will always continue to exist, then that frees our mind open to think of what are the forms of governance we really would like to live under. And if we think of the U.S. in particular, but actually maybe the nation-state form of governance in general, and this is where I think kind of the analysis of Palestine and Israel also come into question, we can start to say, what if we don't presume this has to be the way we have to live? Then we can ask ourselves, what are alternative forms of governance that we might want to develop? And here, this is where I think Indigenous peoples have a contribution to make, because based on memories of pre-colonial Indigenous governance systems, not to make a claim about how all, you know, Native nations operated prior to colonization, but at least in some of these memories, we have a notion of an Indigenous nationhood that is not the same as a nation state. And hence, we can call into question the assumption that the goal of a national liberation struggle is to attain a nation state, right? Or, conversely, that a nation state can actually free oppressed groups. So these ideas then that have developed around Indigenous nationhood are understandings of nation that are not kind of this ethnic cleansing, bounded, we're in, you're out, screw the rest of the world, but our understanding that we are in relationship to the entire world, to all of creation and to all peoples, and we need to act in a respectful way in this kind of global context. And also that we can govern ourselves not through hierarchy and domination, but through principles of consensus, mutual respect, and interrelatedness. So Ingrid Wishnawatak puts it this way. We understand the concept of sovereignty as woven through a fabric that encompasses our spirituality and responsibility. This is a cyclical view of sovereignty that differs greatly from the concept of Western sovereignty, which is based on absolute power. For us, absolute power is in the creator and the natural order of all living things, not in human beings. Our sovereignty is related to our connections to the earth and is inherent. And Lakota Hardin also puts it this way. There's often the assumption when we talk about sovereignty struggles that that means everybody else has to leave. But Lakota Hardin describes Indigenous sovereignty as based on freedom for all peoples. She states, if it doesn't work for one of us, it doesn't work for any of us. The definition of sovereignty means that none of us are free unless all of us are free. We can't, we won't turn anyone away. And how can this be accomplished? Well, key to this understanding of nationhood is a different understanding of land. That is, kind of in the current colonial context, when your land is being encroached upon, the way you're forced to respond is in the court system to say, it's not your land, it's our land. But what you don't get to ask is, what should be the best relationship between peoples and land? Should land be a commodity that can be bought and sold and controlled by one group of people? Or is land something that we all need to respect and we all need to share responsibility for? And Patricia Montour Angus states it this way. She says, although Aboriginal peoples maintain a close relationship with the land, it is not about control of the land. Earth is mother and she nurtures us all. It is the human race that is dependent on the earth and not vice versa. Sovereignty, when defined as my right to be responsible, requires a relationship with territory and not a relationship based on control of that territory. What must be understood, then, is that the Aboriginal request to have our sovereignty respected is really a request to be responsible. I don't know of anywhere else on Earth where a group of people have had to fight so hard to be responsible. So as Glenn Coulthard, who we have voted as tallest and smartest person in Native Studies, points out, is that a lot of our organizing is often based on this politics of recognition. Let's have the state recognize our claims, right? But when you do so, you actually even end up putting yourself in the category of a racial minority status, despite claims to be arguing for sovereignty, and the state's going to adjudicate between these competing claims. What if instead we asserted our sovereignty by seeking recognition with each other rather than from the settler state itself? And as he knows, these politics of recognition then impact the way we even see our own struggles for sovereignty and self-determination. He says, the key problem with the politics of recognition when applied to the colonial context is that it rests on the problematic assumption that the flourishing of Indigenous peoples as distinct and self-determining agents is somehow dependent on their being granted recognition and institutional accommodation from the surrounding settler state and society. Not only will the terms of recognition tend to remain the property of those in power to grant to their inferiors in ways they deem appropriate, but also under these conditions, the Indigenous population will often come to see their limited and structurally constrained terms of recognition granted to them as their own. essentially they start to identify with white liberty and white justice. Now, I think these critiques also necessarily have a feminist slant to them, because when you critique this nation form, state form of governance, you start to realize that the building block of this is heteropatriarchy. And to see how these are linked, we will now turn to the Christian right, who will explain it to us. This is from a Charles Colson from Prison Fellowship, who explains that the cause of terrorism is same-sex marriage. Marriage is the traditional building block of human society, intended to unite couples and bring children into the world. There is a natural moral order for the family. Marriage is not a private institution designed solely for the individual gratification of its participants. If we fail to enact a federal marriage amendment, we can expect not just more family breakdown, but more criminals behind bars and more chaos in the street. It's like handing moral weapons of mass destruction to those who would use America's depravity to recruit more snipers, more hijackers, and more suicide bombers. We must preserve traditional marriage in order to protect the United States from those who would use our depravity to destroy us. And World Magazine, a Christian right magazine, further explained that the cause of the Abu Ghraib prison crisis was feminism. Because feminism causes women to become disoriented about their gender roles, join the army, and abuse prisoners. So what is being explained here is that heteropatriarchy is the logic that naturalizes other forms of social domination. That is, just as men are supposed to naturally rule women on the basis of biology, so too should the elites of a society naturally rule everyone else. So that's why when colonizers first came to these lands, one of their first projects was targeting people who do not fit into kind of a binary gender system, and also a primary project was instituting patriarchy within Native communities. Because if your community is not ordered on the basis of social hierarchy, why would you accept colonial domination from somebody else? The only reason we continue to live under these oppressive conditions is because we think they're normal, natural, and inevitable, right? So, and patriarchy is what makes these things seem natural. So a key then to ending structures of domination is to denaturalize them, and that is why addressing heteropatriarchy must be central to any struggle against white supremacy or settler colonialism. And in addition to this, we have to look at how sexual violence is a key strategy for colonialism. Because when we look at, say, the history of Indian massacres, colonizers did not just kill Native peoples, but they tried to kill their sense of even being a people. These massacres were always accompanied with sexual mutilation, rape, etc. Because the goal was to render Native peoples as inherently rapable, and by extension, their lands inherently invadable and their resources inherently extractable. So therefore, when we have our sovereignty struggles or other racial justice struggles, etc., not really challenge heteropatriarchy, then we cannot successfully end white supremacy or settler colonialism either. Bringing back Glenn Coulthard, we have essentially internalized a white supremacist form of self-determination as our own struggle, right? So we need to make those links central. And I should mention that at the 2008-9, whatever, this last year, social forum in Brazil, there was a whole day dedicated to the struggle of indigenous peoples. And I thought it was very striking that the indigenous peoples in Latin America were making consensus statements saying that the primary thing they wanted to get across is that we need to end the nation-state form of governance. They said that it hasn't worked for the last 500 years, so we don't think it's going to start working now. And they also directly linked it as a patriarchal institution based on kind of a Western epistemological framework. And I thought it was very striking that some of the groups located in the Amazon were saying that they are facing literal physical extinction as we speak. It's not metaphorical. They're literally being shot and killed as we speak. But when they came to the swarm, they said, we're not here primarily to save ourselves. We're here to save the world. And to save the world, we need to live together in a radically different way. And when they articulated their view of sovereignty, they said it's not an issue of saying it's our land versus somebody else's land. They said everybody can be part of the land, but you have to live in a radically relational way to the land And if you can do so, then we can all be welcome because we all need to care for the land in a responsible way. So I think we should listen to what's going on in these movements and rethink how we articulate what should be the goal of a struggle for self-determination and sovereignty. So with that then, now that we've heard all these ideas, how do we operationalize them? And I think a key way to operationalize these politics is through the revolution, through trial and error. That is, if anybody really knew how to end global oppression, we probably would have done it by now. So let's just admit we don't really know what we're talking about, and we're just going to try stuff out and see what happens. You know? Try an idea. If it works, let us know. If it doesn't work, please let us know so we don't do that ourselves. And then kind of continue to share and struggle as we go along, again, recognizing that whatever cool idea we come up with today, it's going to get co-opted tomorrow anyway. So we'll have to have another idea the day after. So we have to have kind of what Kara calls a jazzy response to social justice organizing. So with that then, I want to share some of the ideas that people are thinking about, not to say that these are the answer, but maybe they will be thought-provoking for us as we think of what we can do in our particular context. So I think a key thing to consider when we think about organizing is to, I don't have a blackboard, so you have to visualize a diagram here with me, okay? Just concentrate. Anyway, so think of like a pyramid system here. And this is really what global oppression is, right? We have 5%, the top of the pyramid, that owns 95% of the wealth. And the bad news is they have all the money and the guns. But the good news is there's a lot more of us than them, right? But the key is we need to get this other 95% mobilized. So it's not enough to do just activist work. We have to do work that brings people who aren't already activists into the work. We have to be doing constantly base-building work. And this is what I learned in Latin America. Activists in Chile were telling me, they go, we laugh at you. He said, you get all excited if you get 200 people to a protest, and then you get a police permit to march against police brutality. What good does that do? They said, well, Chile, when Pinochet came to power, we got 1 million people out each week, which would be in the U.S. the counterpart of 40 million people out each week. So that's the kind of scale we need to think about. It's not enough to just get, even if you get 100,000 people to march D.C., well, if next year it's the same 100,000 people, it's not a challenge to the system. It's not a challenge until the movement becomes to grow and grow and gets bigger and bigger. So with that then, how do we think about building movements? And one idea that has come up particularly from indigenous movements in Latin America is the idea of taking power through making power. They said they previously operated under what they called the machismo-leninismo model of organizing. They said this is the idea that we're going to get our guns, go to the mountains, and take over the state. And they said it didn't work out as well as we'd hoped because the movements were so hierarchical that we ended up replicating the same hierarchies we thought we were getting rid of. But also these movements were not very inclusive because how many people had the time to get up their guns, take over the state? So they said instead they realized, well, and folks in Chiapas said this particular, we originally had the idea we would fight the state directly, but we realized they had all the guns, so it was kind of a losing proposition. But they said, what if we started to create the world we want to live in now? And more importantly, what if we started to kind of create these autonomous communities, kind of divest from the state, your own healthcare, educational systems, etc., and also start to implement alternative governance systems that are based on different principles of radical participatory democracy, etc. And the important thing is it's not just enough to put forth a cool hippie commune zone, but you have to proliferate these zones so that they get bigger and bigger and there's more and more of them. Well, eventually, if you achieve a mass scale, what can the guns do if we all start to live differently? So again, that becomes the idea of taking power by making power. You know, instead of taking out the state directly, squeeze out the state by creating the world that we actually want to live in. When that happens, then you start to realize the importance of developing a movement where you don't leave your life to join the movement, but you integrate the movement into the life you're already leaving. So for instance, if you all have to cook anyway, well, can we collectivize that cooking system and then integrate, you know, education on agribusiness or other such things? So how do we make it part of what we're already doing rather than thinking it's another full-time job we have to add to the job that we currently have? So to give one example, one person from Insight went to visit the factory movement in Argentina, and this is the movement where people are just directly taking over the factories, reorganizing the work, and they're also living together communally. And since everybody shares the work, she went in to sign up for her task. But she had just given birth recently, and so she was breastfeeding. So when she went to sign up for her task, they said, you're breastfeeding, and we recognize that as work.
So that they recognized as that work, and that you didn't have to sign it for an additional chore. So it was a recognizing that all of this work that needs to be kind of collectivized. So then we think, well, how would this kind of be operationalized maybe in the US or Canadian context? And of course, we don't tend to see such huge movements because largely we do the organizing through the nonprofit model. And this was kind of, and visualize this next diagram. They said this is, in Latin America, their visual representation of the nonprofit system. So let's say on the top we have this highway, the superhighway of capitalism and colonialism. Everybody's driving their SUV, gas-guzzling cars, you know, tripping along. And what happens, however, is that in the U.S. context in particular, where you're living in the belly of the beast, the system cannot afford for us to be seriously organized. However, also because it's in the belly of the beast, the U.S. has so much money, they have interesting strategies to address a possible organizing. So what they can do is, along this superhighway, they can build an alternative highway that goes around in circles. And you can drive in this alternative highway with your Toyota Prius car, and you can feel very countercultural. And you fail to notice that this highway is still swimming along. They built this highway for you, and you're driving around in circles, right? So this is essentially what they say is going on with the nonprofit system, where our organizing effort is being managed by the state and by capital. And so, and this manifests in a negative way for organizing in numerous ways. Well, the most obvious way we can see is kind of the huge foundations and how they impact our work, like the Ford Foundation. For instance, how it's been documented how the Ford Foundation used its funding deliberately to ensure that the anti-apartheid struggle against South Africa would not have an anti-capitalist critique, right? And I can say, on a personal level with Insight, we had a little run-in with the Ford Foundation ourselves because they gave us this $100,000 grant, told us to go spend it. So after we committed our funds, they then retracted it over our statement on Palestine. So we had like $60,000 we had to raise in like 3 weeks. And what we found is we actually did raise it by calling a lot of people, so that goes to show sometimes you don't need the funding that you think you need to do, but this also shows how these big foundations dictate the terms by which you may think to struggle or organize. But even if we're not talking about the most evil foundations, what about the cool grassroots foundations, etc.? Nevertheless, even though they may have the best intentions, they want to do good, when we get funding in that way, it changes the way we think about our organizing as well in ways we're not often conscious of. So first of all, what tends to happen is that because we're getting funded by foundations and we're not getting funded by our constituents, we don't have an incentive to get more constituents, right? So we end up having movements that don't grow because our salaries are not dependent on having growing movements. And in addition, then we become accountable to the foundation rather than to our constituents, who then don't feel any investment in the work that we are doing. And then because we're getting paid, we start to develop a model of career activism where you think you're not going to be an activist unless you get paid to do the work. But as we go back to our pyramid system, with this whole 95% we need to get mobilized, obviously they can't all get paid to do organizing work, right? So what's happening is a few people are getting paid to work 500 hours a week to replicate the work that millions of people need to be doing, then they get all burnt out and cranky and screw up the movement. So so it becomes a problem. In addition, in order to keep getting these foundations, what ends up getting prioritized in organizations is good administrators rather than organizers, right? Who can write a good grant, who can do bookkeeping, etc. And obviously the people who tend to have these skills are often have a more higher formal education than people who may be doing grassroots organizing but don't have that same skill set. So we don't end up prioritizing people whose primary skill sets might be grassroots organizing. Then the other problem with the foundations is that they tend to fund very short-term fundable strategies. What looks good kind of for a photo op? But if you think about grassroots organizing, that probably will require about 50 years of knocking on people's doors. It's just not that exciting looking, right? And it doesn't look that fundable, but that's the long-term work that's needed to build sustainable movements. And also, because we get funded for strategies, we tend to become wedded to those strategies because otherwise we won't get refunded. But what if you're doing your work and you realize that strategy doesn't work? You don't feel the freedom to say, oops, made a mistake, let's try something else, because you're worried about what's going to happen to your funding. So then what happens is you try this thing out, it really doesn't work, but you tell the funder it did work, and then they tell everybody it worked successfully, so everybody else adopts your failed methods, and before you know it, you're proliferating disasters. So therefore, I think what we need to do is kind of, it's not so much having this purist response to saying nonprofits are always evil, but rethinking the role of the nonprofit in social justice organizing. And again, this is where I've learned from movements in other contexts. It's not that they don't have nonprofits, it's just that they don't do the organizing through the nonprofit. People develop independently funded social movements, and if they want a specific thing funded, they might set up a front nonprofit, but the nonprofit answers to the movement. It's not the movement itself. And if it gets defunded, then they're not screwed. So if we think about, say, the context of anti-violence organizing, it's not so much that domestic violence or sexual assault agencies are evil, but what if instead of thinking of them as the movement, what if we thought of building an independent anti-violence movement that those agencies supported? We might then be able to expand our reach for getting resources, but also we would not then be dependent on them to have our movements grow. So then, when we think about kind of these kind of different ways of organizing, like how can we organize differently so that it engages millions and millions of people and not just a few career activists, we also start to see the importance of doing the organizing in a radically different way. And in particular, we see the need to build a more fun revolution. And this is what I learned from the Christian right, because I was going to the Promise Keepers conferences. I don't know if you have them here, the big evangelical men's movement. But they're in these huge stadiums, you know, to praise Jesus and become, you know, more responsible in their homes, etc. And what I noticed about these conferences is they were a lot of fun. You know, they had hot dogs and Cracker Jacks, and everybody's singing, everybody's nice to you, and the poor Stan has a problem with pornography. Nobody yelled at him, but they would just say, oh, Stan, we want you to be the Christian you can be. We'll be a community of accountability for you. It's very nurturing. Then when I go to meetings on the left, they last like 5 hours, and the chairs are uncomfortable, and there's no food, and everybody yells at you for being kind of revolutionary. And then we wonder why no one wants to join. Right? So I think when we start to organize in this super intense way, like revolution's around the corner, so we can't have any fun now, well, it's not too long before you're burnt out and running off to the day spa or the shopping mall, right? So I think then the key is how do we think about building movements that are nourishing, that give to you as much as you give to them. And I think this would be important for academics, because academics like to say, I'm just too sick, tired, busy, or depressed to do organizing work. But the problem is, if we're going to build a movement around everybody who's not sick, tired, busy, or depressed, we have two people to end global oppression, right? So I think we have to, one, rethink the idea of why should academics not have to do organizing work as compared to beekeepers, grocery store workers, or florists, right? Doesn't everybody need to be doing this work? But for it to not seem so overwhelming, again, we have to get out of the career activist model and think about how to integrate it into the work we're already doing. So if you think of how can I give up 20 more hours out of my work week to do organizing, that might seem overwhelming, but if it was a half hour a week, that might seem a lot more doable. But if millions of people did this extra half hour a week, we'd probably see a lot more change than we're currently seeing at the moment. And again, I think this also entails then having a gendered analysis of how we do the work, because we tend to have this private-public distinction, which is the only collective work we do is in the, quote, public sphere. Like, we're going to organize together to do a protest or do a march, etc. But when it talks about, we think about daycare or cooking or day-to-day maintenance, that's on your own time. So obviously, the people who are more burdened with these tasks are not going to also be able to go do all these street protests at the same time. But if we collectivize all of this work together, then it might start to be doable for everybody to be integrated into movements, because it wouldn't be like they have to leave their life to do this kind of organizing. And there's very interesting models going on. For instance, in Pachamama in Brooklyn, New York, they organize a daycare cooperative because everybody needs daycare, and they do the organizing through the cooperative itself. And they actually learned this from the Sandinista movement in Nicaragua, where the daycare centers were a locus of revolutionary activity that went under the radar because nobody could assume that people needing daycare might actually be doing revolutionary work at the same time. So kind of opening up these organizing spaces in a creative way start to enable us to see a different way of doing movement building that can be sustainable in the long term. So when we look at this, this might seem kind of all very pie in the sky, but I think the kind of these more kind of quote utopic visions are very important to us because they are a barometer of where we're going. Because if we don't know where we're going, how do we measure the effectiveness of our short-term strategies? So to illustrate, I was at an anti-violence conference, and we were in a workshop, and the question that was presented to us was, in 20 years, what would you like to see? And everybody said things like more shelters and more hotlines, and nobody said less violence. Like, we actually forgot why we were there in the first place. If we had remembered what we were trying to do, we would have dug a lot of these strategies a long time ago. But if we don't keep the vision in our forefront at all times, then we are easily to get wedded into these strategies without asking ourselves, are these strategies working? Are they taking us closer to where we want to go or farther away? And obviously, again, when we think about kind of our long-term vision, it's always a provisional vision, because if global oppression were to end tomorrow, none of us would be fit to live in it, because we've all been structured by the logics of white supremacy, settler colonialism, heteropatriarchy, etc. But nevertheless, we can be part of a creative political project where we try new things, we learn from each other, and we kind of take us closer to where we want to go, knowing that the vision will change as we change ourselves. So with that, then, I'd kind of like to end with a quote from John Holloway, who kind of, I think, articulates his understanding of revolution through trial and error. He says, "Revolutionary change is more desperately urgent than ever, but we do not know anymore what revolution means. Our not knowing is the not knowing of those who understand that not knowing is part of the revolutionary process. We have lost all certainty, but the openness of uncertainty is central to revolution. Asking we walk, say the Zapatistas. We ask not only because we do not know the way, we do not, but also because asking the way is part of the revolutionary process itself." Thank you. Questions, comments, or disagreements? Yeah. Yes?
I'm an 87-year-old World War II veteran.
Uh-huh.
And I was very intrigued by your idea of sovereignty. Of course, World War started back in 1914, as we know.
Mm-hmm.
Second World War, 1939. And people were talking about, if there's a third World War, that's it. The human race is finished because we're in the nuclear age.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're whole theory about sovereignty, I thought you were going to go ahead and say that if the people are sovereign, one of the aspects of sovereignty means that we have freedom of choice.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about the nation state as being dysfunctional and a war game and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I gave up my nationality when I was 26 years old because I figured out that I'm not going to play the war game anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I was a bomber pilot in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
My brother died at Salerno. And I called myself at that same day, I said, I'm going to choose a higher level of citizenship like the founding fathers of the United States did in 1789. Now the idea of world citizenship, that's what I thought you were coming to.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is one of the oldest ideas in the history books.
Mm-hmm.
Socrates called himself a world citizen back in 2,500 years ago. Etc. The ancient Greeks used to call themselves world citizens. Then that to me is where we're at. If we don't recognize that our lives are at stake and that we have the right to choose our own political allegiance, and that allegiance has to correspond to one world, which you've been talking about, thank God, then we're done. In other words, my question to you is, you mentioned everything except the famous words, the heretic words, world government. Now, I was waiting for it, but I didn't hear it. I'd like to hear your opinion. If it's true that the human race is sovereign and in danger, and we all know that because the nuclear option is on the table, isn't it not only possible, but inevitable that we have to have a world government of, for, and by the people of the world? Your opinion.
I think these are difficult ideas that we should all, I don't have the answer, let's put it this way, but I would say maybe one modification of that would be, I think indigenous peoples have very radical relationships to specific land bases, and I think the idea of world citizenship can kind of occlude this. And I think with the trap that tends to happen is that people assume because people's mind have a radical relationship to a specific land base that the relationship must be understood in very exclusionary terms. So I think there may be a way to understand both of these things together, that when maybe we visit some group's territory, we recognize they may have the original instructions for how that land should be cared for, but we can maybe still take part in that if we follow those original instructions from that particular land base. But if we get into this kind of super cosmopolitanism, we tend to think everybody and everything is fungible across territories, and I think then that doesn't respect, again, people's relationship to their specific lands and the spirituality that's tied to that.
I wanted to say, because what you stated about how things lose their focus and how many times causes become the economics of doing good, and one prime example that's happening in Canada right now is what's called the matrimonial real property rights, and that's in conjunction with Aboriginal women in this country. And what's happened with this issue is that it's based on, in terms of Aboriginal women's perspective, simply, it's based on safety. That's all we were calling for, because women don't hold land in Canada. We don't hold land. It always follows the patriarchal lineage. And so when we say, when there's a domestic dispute, what happens most times is that the women and children have to leave. And then when the women and children leave, they're forced into a setting, most times urban, where they can't survive, even if they try. But nonetheless, the matrimonial real property right has now moved to this place where the present government is presenting it as if, oh, Aboriginal women are now getting a say. You're getting access to matrimonial real property rights, and there's going to be this division of 50-50 of everything. And what we're saying as Aboriginal women, the government is saying, oh, we consulted with the Assembly of First Nations, the Native Women's Association of Canada. Yes, they did these things, as our presenter was talking about, handed over money, and now they're calling it consultations. And we never for a moment understood it as a consultation, and we stated that clearly. And even the talks that did happen only probably was like 0.03% of the Aboriginal population. So matrimonial real property rights, as it's being presented by the Canadian government, is just that. It's economics. It's another way of getting at Aboriginal land. And it's again through and on the backs of our women. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Questions or comments?
Hi, Andy. I want to thank you for your talk. And I just want to address the issue of the indigenous of Latin America. In the Amazon especially, what's happening there now is that they are being physically extinct. And one of the main reasons is Canadian and American mining companies who are going there to mine our resources. I want to know how these links can be made clear.
Well, I just think on one hand, I think this is one of the internalized colonialisms that has happened. We're thinking anything south of the border is not indigenous somehow at this point. And so even when you go to, say, UN events, there's often a huge divide between indigenous peoples, in Latin America and in Canada. And in the U.S. in particular, is like the worst. So I think, one, we have to recognize that these borders have been set up primarily to make sure we can't build huge indigenous movements. And it just makes no sense, because the movements are so much larger in Latin America, we would have so much more political strength. So I think, I think that's why it's critical, maybe this back to the role of citizenship idea, I think of more global solidarity, recognizing that there's no such thing as self-determination for one nation. We're all governed by these logics of capitalism, white supremacy, settler colonialism. So if we're not part of a global movement to dismantle them collectively, no nation's going to survive. So I just think that has to be start to develop part of our ethos.
Can I have a follow-up question?
I'd like to give opportunities to other people. We only have a few minutes.
That's why I asked.
Thank you. Anyone else? We have time for a few more questions. Okay, great.
Thank you. I guess it's just a bit of a follow-up question in terms of one of the sort of strategies you're outlining. And I realize when you're talking about what the Zapatistas did in terms of sort of a prefigurative state model, it's going to look very different in Canada and the U.S. But I think there is a tension in terms of taking on services that have been provided by the state, mm-hmm. and especially these battles within the left on that. I mean, in Canada, I think healthcare is the epitome of that, right? Mm-hmm. People fought to get healthcare from the state, and so mm-hmm. now they want to defend that rather than saying, let's take that over ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that tension can exist in other areas. I'm wondering if you've dealt with that or if you have any sort of further thoughts on how to deal with that issue of letting gains go or sort of in kind of allowing neoliberalism to take tasks away from the state under the guise of doing it ourselves, for ourselves.
I think that's an excellent question. Again, I don't think it has a simple solution, but I tend to think of it not so much as letting go, because for one thing, I think pretty much everybody has to have a job in some industrial complex. If it's not the academic industrial complex, it's the nonprofit industrial complex or whatever. So wherever you are, I think, why not try to make that, squeeze as much space out of that as possible and get as much out if you can as possible. I think what tends to go wrong is when that's our sole investment. And I think that if we had one foot in whatever place we're trying to make space, but we had another foot in the independent movement that was trying to build something else, one, I think we'd be stronger in the industrial complex where we have a day job because we have people behind us, and two, we'd have a movement holding us accountable, right? So I see room for a both and a strategy. It's like the academia is that, we have these tenure battles. I certainly know I was stuck in one, but I think it would be very politically limiting if we thought a liberatory education is going to happen in the academic industrial complex, and I would hope we would start to think of building alternative educational models that really are liberating, and the more we did that, I think we'd actually make more progress in the academic industrial complex at the same time. So I see it as kind of a multiple both and strategy. I don't think there's a purest place to work where you're not implicated in evilness in some way. So that's why it's, again, about accountability, having a movement of people behind you to help you adjudicate those issues.
Okay. I think we have time for one last one.
Thank you. Great talk. And I loved your book, The Revolution Will Not Be Funded. But you mentioned twice the issue of Israel-Palestine, and up until recently that seemed to be a topic that was mostly carried out by Palestinians and anti-Zionist Jews. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that's an important topic to bring up, and you know, does it have ramifications in the North American context for liberation?
Yeah, I think it has profound implications in a number of ways. One thing is, I think the assumption that if you have a critique of Israel, you're therefore anti-Semitic, again rests on the assumption that the way to liberate an oppressed group is through a nation state. So I think that's the assumption behind the inability to make that critique. If we understand that the nation state is in fact organized state violence that isn't going to liberate anybody, then we should be able to critique all states and then start to ask ourselves what would be truly liberating for the world. When you do that, then you can stop having this thing of saying either you care about anti-Semitism committed against Jewish people, or you care about Palestinian liberation. When things are presented in a dualistic way, you have to ask yourselves who framed the debate in that manner and who's benefiting from that debate. And of course, who's benefiting from that is U.S. imperialism. And also, it's allowing U.S. imperialism to not look at its own entrenched settler colonialism that's foundational to its very being. So I feel that the states of Israel and U.S. are completely interlinked, and I think it behooves us to kind of call into question the terms of the debate and say that there's a different way we can look at these issues to foster a movement of global liberation for everyone. But that's one of many things we could say about it. And I think it's critical that we make this central to all liberation struggles and not see this as, again, it's always framed as it's two groups that don't get along, and recognize it as a settler colonial issue that needs to be addressed as such. Okay, thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
We'll close this session and we'll see you this afternoon in the hall. Thanks.